Show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTDHD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. Hearing in the background the wonderful saxophone playing of Frank Catalano. This is my one and only love from his album called Bang. And Frank Catalano, the Frank Catalano Quartet, actually, are one of the headliners for this weekend's Harbor Park Jazz Rhythm and Blues Festival in the heart of downtown Kenosha. And of course, year after year, it's my great pleasure to speak with various jazz artists, jazz greats, who are part of this wonderful event. And it's my pleasure to talk for the next few minutes with saxophonist Frank Catalano, so highly regarded in the business with a number of different albums to his credit, including Bang, Love Supreme Collective, Mighty Burner, and his most recent album called God's Gonna Cut You Down. We'll hear the title track from that a little bit later on. But in the meantime, we want to talk to Frank Catalano about his life and his career and a few interesting twists along the way that make his story exceptionally interesting. Frank Catalano, we welcome you to the morning show.
Oh, thanks so much, Greg, for having me.
Really happy to have this opportunity. Thank you for making time for it in what I know is a busy schedule. Let's get a little bit of biography stuff out of the way. Tell us first where you come from originally and at what point the saxophone started to become an important part of your life.
Well, I am definitely a native Chicagoan, and getting to grow up in the Chicagoland area, I think the first, like, legendary person that I heard that just blew me away was Von Freeman, a famous saxophone player who passed away about 3 years ago. Luckily for him, late in life, like when he was in his 80s, I would say, I think he was 89 when he passed away. So I would say the last 10 years of his life, he, you know, was pretty internationally regarded, got the Jazz Masters Award from the National Endowment for the Arts. But he would have been, I guess, in maybe his mid-60s at the time when I first heard him, and I was, I don't think, even quite 10 yet. Right around 10, I started playing saxophone when I was 7 and piano when I was 2, and when I heard him play, I just, you know, Lizzie would try to make it out to every one of his performances as possible, and he would always have me, I would say after we knew each other for about 6 months, he would always say, well, did you bring your horn? And he would always invite me to sit in with him. So that's probably the best learning experience a young musician can get, to be able to sit in with people that they really admire, and maybe you make some mistakes and something doesn't go well, and then you realize not to do that again. So it was just a great learning experience and a great time as a young person.
Hmm. The saxophone, of course, is one of those instruments where there's a whole family of, you know, soprano, alto, tenor, baritone. And I wonder, as you started messing around with the saxophone and then started to get serious with it, which variations of the saxophone felt the most comfortable to you and why?
That's a great question. Normally, everyone has to kind of start off on alto sax. They used to start people off on clarinet and then move them to the alto sax. But as soon as I saw the tenor sax, I just knew that's the one that I wanted to play. And when I saw Von Freeman playing it, I just thought it looked cool, the way the neck curves, and the sound is a little darker and more meaty. So I did start on alto. I played alto for, you know, a couple of years, and then I switched to tenor. I do play all the saxophones, and I've pretty much recorded on all of them, from soprano, which is higher pitch on soprano, and the Chinese saxophone, to bass, which is lower than the baritone and is about, you know, 5.5 feet taller, so it's a big saxophone. So I've played all of them, but tenor is by far my favorite.
Hmm. What is the difference technically between playing those different kinds of saxophones? I mean, how different is the fingering? How different is the mechanics of blowing? I mean, I suspect that the basics of playing the instrument remain fairly constant, but how high a variation are we talking about in terms of really perfecting your technique with each of them?
That's another great question, because they all are very different. I would say, even though the fingerings are technically, you know, basically the same from one to the other, although the altissimo range varies quite a bit on all of them, you probably can't use the same fingerings on a baritone saxophone for the highest register, the saxophone, the altissimo register, as you could the tenor. So there is some differences, but for the most part, it's the way your armature is and the way your ear string is, because the saxophones, let's say like soprano, the higher pitch ones, you have to have a very different armature. The mouthpiece is very small, and anything you do nuance-wise will probably make the intonation be very bad. You have to really just be very, very controlled. Tenor, you can be a little more inflective on, because I think it's it takes quite a bit of air. You can play with an embouchure that's a little bit more relaxed, so you can, put more nuances in the sound. Like the bass, the lowest one, it is very difficult to play. Not only does it take a lot of air, so your air stream and your breathing and your diaphragm and lungs all have to be in sync with each other, but the embouchure is definitely not giving. It's a very large mouthpiece, and you have to play with a lot of air, but it can't be very focused. It has to have I would call it like a wide air stream, so that a lot of air is going into the saxophone, but not with a lot of speed. So there is a lot of differences as far as actually being very competent on them. I think most saxophone players could pick one up and get the notes out and be okay and making some sound, but they actually play it at a high level. They're all very specialized. And because of that, I pretty much like to stick the tenor for 99% of all my stuff. And then once in a while, when I need to or when I'm feeling like it, I'll pick up one of the other ones, the soprano, alto, baritone, bass, for very specialized things. And, practice that the week coming up to the recording or so. But for the most part, I think it's best to pick one and stick with it. So for me, tenor is definitely my favorite in the saxophone.
Tenor sax. When you were in high school, and of course, one of the things that's intriguing about your resume is that you actually really got to encounter and even share the stage with a lot of great, great professional musicians. I mean, at a very tender young age. Before we talk about that, were you someone that, for instance, in junior high and high school was playing saxophone in just your regular old school band? Or were you really inhabiting kind of the world of jazz exclusively right from the start?
I was totally just like a band nerd, having fun playing in the jazz band and in the like radio concert band during the day. But pretty much every night I was, you know, either in Andy's Jazz Club or the Green Mill or the New Apartment Lounge or the Velvet Lounge or Green Dolphin Street when that came up. I was always somewhere playing or sitting in. Pretty much, I would say 5-6 nights a week, to the point where my mom was getting pretty concerned and didn't like me being out so much. But I would say from the time I was probably, you know, 11 or 12, pretty much, you know, have just, you know, 24 hours a day been thinking about music pretty much. Even when I'm sleeping, I'm thinking about it.
Tell us how it was possible for you to encounter so many really spectacular professional musicians at such a young age. How in fact did that happen, and what kind of a difference did it make in shaping you into the artist that you are today?
Well, I would say three people that really facilitated all that the most and helped me out the most. One is Von Freeman, who I mentioned, who through him and getting to play with him at, you know, the Bop Shop, the other clubs I mentioned, sitting in with him at jazz festivals, you know, while I was in high school, I got to meet so many people, from Miles Davis to Betty Carter to, I pretty much, you know, can say, you know, the who's who of jazz, and this would be now over 25 years ago, like late 80s. So I just can't thank him enough up in heaven for all he has done for me. But a lot of the people came through him. And then another large amount of people came from my high school band director, Dick Robertson, who I saw the other day, who helped put together a really fun concert for me. And he's been retired for over 20 years, but we still keep in touch. And Mark Fetcher, who used to run Elgin Community College's jazz program, and since I was 14, even though I was only, you know, freshman in high school, I started playing in their college band. And they would always have, you know, famous guest artists come in. And one was Randy Brecker, who then we've done quite a few recordings together because we just kind of became friends, and he thought I was a good young player and was being supportive. And that is 25 years ago, and we played together not that long ago at the Iridium in New York, so I mean, we still play together quite a bit and have done quite a few recordings together. And Louis Belton was one of the guest artists. Same thing, Louis Belton asked me how old I was. I told him I was 14. He's like, okay, well, you know, Jimmy Dorsey started hiring me when I was 16, so how about in 2 years from now, I started hiring you? And I kind of thought he was kidding, but I gave him my phone number. This is way before Facebook and email. So it was truly my mom's, you know, home phone number. And, you know, he called me the next week just to say hi, and we talked like once a month. And sure enough, in a year or two, he started hiring me to, you know, go on the road with him. And he was truly a legend that everyone admired, you know, invented the double bass drum, was Duke Ellington and Count Basie's drummer for a long time. So every, you know, so many people loved and respected Louis Belton. When I'd be out playing with him, they would almost always ask me to play things at their venues, and or if they were musicians, ask if I was up for playing. So I would say those three people, Duke Robertson, my high school band director, Mark Fetcher from ECC, and Von Freeman, started it off, and then things just kind of grew from there.
Well, that they certainly have. For those of you just joining us, I am speaking on this portion of the morning show with saxophonist Frank Catalano. He is one of the headliners who's going to be playing this weekend at Kenosha's Harbor Park Jazz Rhythm and Blues Festival. And Saturday at 5:30, the Frank Catalano Quartet is scheduled to perform. Frank Catalano, you share the stage with a lot of different musicians, and sometimes with a fairly substantial group, and sometimes a much sparser sort of group, almost more of a chamber music kind of situation. And I suppose each of those kind of gives you a different kind of musical pleasure.
Oh, definitely. I like playing in, big bands. I like playing in orchestras. I love classical music also. But my favorite way to play probably is my own group with, the quartet configuration, piano, bass, drums, and then myself on saxophone. And that's, I think, probably the most, I don't want to say liberating, but it's not an accident. I don't think that John Coltrane preferred the same thing, and most people that I really admire do, because it's enough people that you can play off of and, make some really interesting things happen with the music, but it's not too many to where it can be bogged down, like the old saying, too many cooks in the kitchen, where, if you're trying to lead the group, and you're asking, basically, musically and at the spirit of the moment while you're improvising, for musicians to go with you, kind of having too many can be, in my opinion, a little bit more difficult. So the piano, bass, and drums, or guitar, bass, and drums is also really fun. But for this Saturday coming up, I know we'll have Stacey McMichael, my regular bass player, Scott Williams, my regular piano player, who was on the one and only Love track that you played. And then a good friend of mine who I always love playing with, who I've been playing with on and off for about 10 years, John Sparrow, who recently just went on tour with the Violent Femmes playing percussion for them, and is a great player. So
great. We are excited about that. We have a couple other things to talk about, but first, let's listen to a little more music. I thought it would be interesting to play a portion of the title track from what I think is your most recent recording called God's Gonna Cut You Down. Before we listen to some of the music, why don't you say a word about maybe this song and this album?
Okay, great. The album is doing really well right now. It's number 8 on the Billboard Jazz charts this week. It's the band I have with Jimmy Chamberlain, who's a longtime drummer for the Smashing Pumpkins, and he's a great jazz musician. He started off as a jazz musician, his dad was a jazz clarinet player, and I always like the song God's Gonna Cut You Down, because it's about a 150-year-old gospel song, and I heard Johnny Cash's version of it about 10 years ago, and I had always said, wow, I'd really like to do a version of this at some point. And all the rest of the songs on the album are original. This is the only cover, but I just really liked it, and I liked the drum groove that Jimmy came up with. It's not what I was expecting for the song, but as soon as I heard it, I was like, wow, this is really cool. I really liked it, and we just did one take of it in the studio, and I was just like, well, let's keep it. Let's make it the title track. And I just really liked how it turned out. And these are types of songs that when we played it live, it's been a little different every time. So you never know exactly how it's going to turn out, meaning like how many choruses or solo sections, and exactly if the groove's going to stay consistent for the whole time or if it's going to get, changed up. But I just really like the way the version on the album turned out. I hope the audience does as well.
Well, here it is. Let's listen to a little bit of Frank Catalano off of his latest album, God's Gonna Cut You Down. Thank you. Oh, I hate to pop that down. That is so much fun. God's going to cut you down. And saxophonist Frank Catalano, my guest on this portion of the morning show. We were talking earlier about the various members of the saxophone family, so to speak. And I read, I think it might have been on your website, an article in the New York Times where you were interviewed, and they made mention of all of the saxophones which you own, some 60 different instruments. So the way some little old ladies have 60 cats in their house, you have 60 saxophones. Is that sort of by design or accident or both? I mean, how is it that you have all of these different instruments, and how many of them do you end up actually playing?
Well, that's a great question, and I guess that article in the New York Times, I want to say, is some of about 4 years ago, and I can say that I have a lot more than 60 at this point, because I have actually purchased quite a few more. I purchased this collection by a famous New York repairman named Dr. Rick, and his website's just drrick.com, and his collection had been up for sale on eBay for a long time, and last year I drove out to New York and purchased that and put it into my SUV and drove it back to Chicago, as well as a few other things. I pretty much, it is almost embarrassing, but I pretty much only play my Yamaha Silver Custom V Tenor on pretty much every video of me, recording session, live stuff. That's what you'll see me playing. But I just really love the craftsmanship and the way that these vintage saxophones are made. So my absolute favorites tend to be ones from the 20s, and some of them have pearls on every key and are gold-plated and engraved top to bottom. They really are like works of art, and most of them play amazing as well. And I just always found it just fascinating that without any, computer-aided anything, people just knew how to make these things. I don't even know who the people are that technically made these instruments. Some are by the Summer Company, some are by the Kahn Company, but I wish there was specific information on the actual craftsmen at the time. I know there's a few that are known, but whoever all of these people were, I mean, there was at least a dozen of just amazing people, true virtuoso craftsmen, and at each company. And then probably the rarest ones I have that aren't playable are from the 1850s. I have a quintet, two sopranos, and also a tenor and a baritone that were made by Adolf Sax, the inventor of the saxophone himself.
Wow.
From his workshop in Paris, and signed by him with his stamp. So those, to me, just from a historical standpoint, I get kind of sentimental when I even like touch them, just to think like how long they've been around. And I got the alto up and playing, totally redone, and just trying to use the type of pads that were around back then without resonators. I mean, really, they are the horse and buggy of the saxophone. They're very, very antiquated and primitive by comparison to current ones, but they actually, once they're padded up like this alto, it plays great, the sound is great. The keys are very different. It doesn't have as many keys, so the range isn't quite the same, and it has this weird double octave mechanism, but just the fact that Adolf Sax made them, 170, 165 years ago, I just find it fascinating.
Cool. I know that as someone who is such a student of the saxophone and a virtuoso in terms of playing it, you've also taken it a step further. Your biography mentions the fact that you have actually patented a device which allows you to, in a sense, connect a saxophone via MIDI to a keyboard. Tell us more about what that makes possible.
Well, it's not something that I'm using too much anymore, but about, I would say, in the mid to late 90s, I was getting asked by a lot of well-known rock bands to go on tour, and a lot of times they would have a keyboard player. A lot of times there we have a full horn section. like trombone, you know, trumpet, saxophone. And then there would be times where maybe there wasn't the ability to have the whole horn section, so they would just say, Frank, you know, can you just play some saxophone solos? And I had had my finger cut off already, and I was trying to think of ways that I could, you know, maybe be equally or more valuable as a sideman if my finger was to not fully recover. And it has, so I'm glad about that. But at the time, 20 years ago, I didn't really know how well my body would recover. And I basically thought, well, if I can have this mount system so that I can put a small, like, one-octave keyboard on the bell of the saxophone, and if I could load in the right samples, I by myself could pretty much be equal to, like, a whole horn section. So I would try with the left hand of the saxophone to play the actual saxophone notes, and then with at least two fingers play, like, a trumpet and a trombone note. And it sounded really cool. And technology, you know, has advanced since then. But for the time, I thought it was really cool.
Yeah.
And then if you, you know, just needed a keyboard player in the band to play some, you know, let's say, synth, like string parts at the opening of a, you know, a song or something like that, I could do that too. So it did lead to me being hired by a lot of different people. And the coolest thing that happened was, Yamaha approached me about purchasing it, and I ended up not actually selling the patent to them because they actually said, I don't think we'll be able to sell enough of these things unless the saxophone player has had their finger cut off and had to relearn their way of playing and stuff. There's not going to be a lot of people to sell it to. But what they did is ask me to come on board as an artist advisory board member and help play test stuff, as well as make me endorse, you know, an endorser for their saxophones, and put together a lot of clinics and festivals. So it was a real, like, true blessing in a whole different way, being a part of Yamaha, because it's, you know, been so cool to me.
Yeah,
But that was truly kind of out of necessity. I'm like, what am I going to do if my chops don't really fully come back? Because I at that point, was still playing saxophone, but I was using my index finger kind of curled up to do both the index finger and the right middle finger keywords. And that was something that was allowing me to play while I was healing up, but I definitely knew that wouldn't be a good thing to do for, like, you know, the next 60 years or whatnot.
Right.
I appreciate you mentioning the keyboard thing I had patented, because, yeah, that's, that really, again, being a lover of music, I just had that idea, like, what more could I do beyond what's currently being done? And it really opened a lot of doors for me.
That's great. We should talk for just a moment about this really traumatic experience of yours in which you severed one of your fingers, and I can scarcely imagine anything more terrifying or awful for a musician to suffer. I read in your biography that it happened in an automobile accident, but then in an article, it was described as happening when you were working on your car. So exactly when did that injury occur, and exactly how did it happen? Not at the risk of having you relive something that I think you would probably just as soon forget.
Well, there was actually two bad accidents. The first one was in the early 90s, and I was working on my car. I was actually supposed to fly out and play a show in California, and my car would barely run. It was an old Volkswagen Beetle. I thought if I could put some oil into it without turning it off, if it was sputtering, would be the best thing. And it was dumb of me, because basically, I went to go to reach for the dipstick, which was between the generator pulley, the two sides. I thought I had plenty of room, but it was obviously in not good repair and kind of sloshing around. And it really did just take my finger and wrap it around the generator pulley and truly just sucked it off. It just, like, yanked it off. And I had let leather gloves on at the time, and it was winter. And I for a couple seconds, I had no idea that something that horrible had happened. It actually kind of threw my hand up in my face, and I remember like almost like punching myself. And my glasses were knocked off. So then I took off the glove, and my blood was everywhere, and my finger was nowhere to be seen. Well, I kind of freaked out, and I ran inside, and I called 911, and I ended up passing out from losing so much blood. But thank God they came, and the finger was still in the glove outside, basically in the snow. So they took my finger, they got me in the ambulance, took me to the hospital, and as soon as they put my finger back on, I actually became good friends with him and started giving his son saxophone lessons shortly thereafter. And it was a long recovery. I mean, still, once something is, a body part has been cut off and put back on, the nerves are always going to be different, and it has a different feeling, but it works really great. And then the second one was about 4 years ago. I was hit by a drunk driver in a car accident, and I was just at a red light, and this guy in a landscape truck just plowed into me, and that's where I tore all the ligaments and cartilage in my left wrist, and my neck, my shoulder, my back, my elbow, just had all types of injuries from that. So 20-some years ago, my right middle finger was cut off, and about 4 years ago, via a car accident, my left wrist was, I'm not going to say ruined, but ironically, repairing ligaments and the cartilage and all this stuff that doesn't really regenerate or grow back too easily in my wrist has actually caused way more problems than having my finger cut off and put back on.
Wow.
Just as far as, like, numbness, difficulties with, swelling and seeing how things function. All I can say, though, is at least for right now, once I get on stage and I just have fun playing, it's kind of like my mind takes over, and it usually doesn't bug me while I'm playing anymore. But I would say 2 or 3 years ago, that was pretty brutal.
Wow.
Just because I just didn't have strength even in my hand at one point to pick up the saxophone.
Wow.
So, yeah, I have definitely had – I'm knocking on some wood now that no one listening us, nobody has any more accidents of any type.
You've had more than your share, that's for sure. Could you just say a word – maybe just say a word about the process of, in a sense – either regaining or rebuilding or transforming your technique to allow you to play again after both of those traumas. And I suspect there's a couple of things going on there. One of them is that you have to allow your body to heal, to actually recover. But the other thing is that there might be ways in which the actual act of playing might really feel different than it did before, and you might really have to, in a sense, adapt or rebuild your technique to accommodate that. Just how complicated a process are we talking about?
Well, when my finger got cut off, I totally had to change my technique because I really did have to have the one finger do the work of two, which is not normal. After my finger started working pretty well again, I was more or less able to go back to my old way of doing stuff. So that, I would say, was something where I changed my technique around for about a year and then went back to the way I had been doing stuff. With the more recent one, with having my whole hand injured, I definitely had to change stuff around because to do a lot of the keys, like the left-hand pinky keys on the saxophone, you have to have quite a bit of force and strength in that part of your hand. And most people's pinky fingers are, not always super strong. And then if you have torn ligaments and cartilage where that your hand attaches to the wrist and stuff, it makes it that much more difficult. So I've had tons of physical therapy, tons of strength, training stuff, just on my own, trying to do isometrics to keep to keep that together. So I haven't really changed my technique so much, but like you were saying, how it might feel different. Playing feels very different to me now than it did 4 years ago, and I definitely have to stay on top of all that because I just don't have as much strength in my arm or hand as I used to. So I feel like I've been able to work around it nicely at this point, but I would say 2011, 2012 were very difficult because while I was still playing shows and whatnot, it almost felt like my hand was not on my arm. I don't know how to best describe it, but it's like I knew my fingers were moving and they were doing, you know, what they were supposed to, but I was not feeling, I was just not feeling it. And it really was because of nerve damage, you know, swelling, other stuff. It didn't have the nuances of feel that it used to. So a lot of that has come back. It's still not how it was. But I do think, fortunately, I had, before that accident, 30 years or 30-some years of playing the saxophone already, like, in my brain. So I was able to make some compensation, you know, hold my hand a little bit different so I could have a better angle for those keys that I was having difficulty with. And it's worked out okay. Hmm. But definitely the feel, the feel is definitely different.
Wow. We're speaking with saxophonist Frank Catalano, who is going to be one of the headliners this weekend for the Harbor Park Jazz Rhythm and Blues Festival. The Frank Catalano Quartet is going to be performing on Saturday at 5:30 on the main stage. Frank Catalano, in our closing minutes, I thought it would be interesting to just get a sense from you of what this life as a professional musician has been like and to what extent it has lived up to your expectations versus how much has it been a surprise in terms of what it's like, what it takes, what it means to be a professional saxophone player?
Well, definitely, I just knew there was nothing else that I wanted to do. I had a landscaping job when I was very young, and that's the only job I've ever had other than playing the saxophone. And I just knew that's what I wanted to do, and I was not worried and just did not care if it paid a lot of money or a little bit of money. And I said to myself, well, as long as I can make a living, that's what I want to do. And in that regard, it's way exceeded any expectations that I've had because I've been able to make a solid living. I've been able to travel all over the world and see so many cool things. I met my wife because of it, because she owns a travel agency, and while she wasn't necessarily a jazz fan or a saxophone fan, then having other mutual interests that came about via being a professional saxophone player, like talking about Italy and various other places, the first time I met her, there was a true connection, and so I can't say it's just one thing or the other, but it's kind of like being out and about and meeting so many people on a daily basis and getting to, you know, perform in front of people. It really opens your mind to so many things way beyond the saxophone or music, other cultures, dealing with different people. In one given day, I might deal with a very, you know, bossy person who has hired me to be on a recording that he's producing for a film score, and there's a lot of deadlines, and he's maybe very grumpy. And then I might go to a grade school and give a clinic for Yamaha about, like, the history of jazz, and then maybe at night I'll play at the Green Mill and maybe sign a 100 CDs or so and talk to a bunch of people. So it's interesting because every day I'm getting put into different situations and meeting different people. So there's no way that it could ever be boring because you don't know what it's going to be and you don't know who you're going to meet and how your day will turn out. So it's always, to me, been very exciting. And, of course, the music itself, I just think it's kind of the duty of somebody, if they're a visual artist, if they're a musician, if they're a screenplay writer, whatever somebody's passion or talent is, I think that even if it's just for fun as a hobby, or if it's something that, someone feels they want to do for a living, we're kind of all obligated, I think, to try to do those things to an extent, because it's kind of, a gift or a talent, and it should be used. I'm just kind of goofy and stubborn, and I wasn't going to take no for an answer, so I just kept barreling through, even when, I remember after I got signed to Del Mar Records, I was only a teenager, and that was so cool because I basically had a really great record deal just kind of fall in my lap from playing at the Green Mill, and Bob Chester, the owner of Del Mar, heard me and liked me. After that record deal, though, expired, I had 3 or 4 not good record deal situations. One actually ended up with me having to buy my own contract back from a bankruptcy court so that I could still record and make music as opposed to just having to sit around for 5 years until the contract expired. So I've had both sides of the coin there, both good and bad. But even those bad experiences are pretty cool in the fact that I always feel like I've learned something from them. And you just keep, making music that you care about and pushing on, and then another good situation will come up. So any advice that I have to anybody, for anybody that's listening out there who wants to be a professional musician, just would be basically to not get discouraged and to just keep honing your skills and to keep being out there and making music, and eventually things will work out. And it's that persistence and the passion that I think is most important.
Well, you've certainly persisted through some trials and tribulations that would have cut some other people down, and we're glad that you're still around and still playing so beautifully. And I know that a lot of people are so excited that you are a part of this year's Harbor Park Jazz Rhythm and Blues Festival here in Kenosha, an absolutely terrific event. And we'll shortly give information on how people can secure tickets for this weekend's event. In the meantime, we're going to listen to a little more music as we say goodbye to you, Frank Catalano. We're going to listen to another track off of your album called Bang, a piece that I just love called Funky Dunky. It's one of my favorites. And with it, we'll say goodbye to you. And I appreciate you making time in your schedule to join me today on the morning show. This has really been fun. And we wish you a great time in Kenosha this weekend with the Harbor Park Jazz and Blues Festival.
Thanks, Greg.
saxophonist Frank Catalano. The Frank Catalano Group is going to be performing at 5:30 this Saturday as part of the Harbor Park Jazz, Rhythm, and Blues Festival on the Kenosha Lakefront, a benefit for the Mary Lou and Arthur F. Mahone Fund, which promotes opportunities for economically or academically disadvantaged youth, and to support breast and cervical cancer initiatives for economically disadvantaged women. This terrific event will feature all kinds of wonderful music, beginning at 1:30 in the afternoon, culminating with the Grammy-winning Rebirth Brass Band at 7 o'clock Saturday night. There will also be the Kenosha Jazz All-Star Tribute Band, featuring some of the most brilliantly talented young people from Kenosha Unified over the last few years under the direction of Ken Wheely. There's also great food being made as part of the festival, and that is a relatively new addition to this this event for the second annual cooking studio at Harbor Park Jazz with Kenosha native and restaurateur Chef Daniel Bonanno and Manja Chef Jason Gorman. You can go to mahonefund.org for more information about this weekend's tremendous event. Tomorrow on the morning show, it is the monthly visit of the United Environmental Council. Nan Calvert will be with us, and we will be talking about the most important pollinators of native plants. Friday, Professor Art Sear from Carthage College pays his monthly visit to the program to offer his analysis of current events. Next week, Monday, and continuing on into Tuesday, you'll hear the interview which I composed with a luminary from the world of heavy metal music, D. Randall Blythe, who is the lead vocalist for a heavy metal band admired around the world called Lamb of God. And he has written an incredible memoir called Dark Days, and we talk about it on Monday and Tuesday's morning show. Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Sunny and warm today, high of 79 degrees, partly cloudy tonight with a low of 62, and sunny tomorrow as we warm up to 86 degrees, 89 for a high on Friday. And remember, no Kenosha Pops tonight.